This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'll tell you what. I'm going to go to the bathroom and powder my nose. You sit here and think of something to say.
I'll do that.
That's my guest Uma Thurman with John Travolta in a scene from Pulp Fiction. This 1994 film, written and directed by Quentin Tarantino, was one of the most influential movies of its decade and turned Thurman into a star. She also starred in Tarantino's two Kill Bill movies as an assassin and martial arts expert out for personal revenge. Thurman has been in all kinds of films, from period dramas like Dangerous Liaisons to romantic comedies like The Truth About Cats and Dogs. She started her career as a model, following in the footsteps of her mother. Her father, Robert Thurman, is a well-known scholar of Tibetan Buddhism. Uma Thurman is starring in the new movie, The Life Before Her Eyes. As the movie begins, a high school student named Diana is in the school's girls' bathroom, talking with her best friend, when they hear shooting and screams. One of the students is massacring teachers and fellow students and is about to break into the bathroom. The movie flashes forward 15 years later. Diana is now a wife, mother, and teacher, having great difficulty facing the anniversary of the massacre. The movie alternates between the teenaged and the adult Diana, with Thurman playing the adult. In this scene, she's at home in the bathroom weeping because earlier in the day, she thought she saw her husband with another woman. Her husband is played by Brett Cullen.
Diana, you need some sleep.
I so loved you. I so loved all of it. I thought if I lived a certain way, cared for my daughter, helped my students, loved you, then I could make everything all right.
What?
You can't understand.
No, I don't understand. I'm your husband.
You're not my husband.
Uma Thurman, welcome to Fresh Air. Your new movie, The Life Before Her Eyes, is in a way like the opposite of Kill Bill in the sense that Kill Bill, you know, it's a revenge fantasy. And so the deaths aren't quite the same as in your new movie, in which these murders in a high school changed everybody from the school, everybody in the whole town, and certainly your character's life. Would you talk a little bit about the contrast for you?
Well, it's a beautifully sensitive drama that's, although not without devices, it's trying to sort of reflect and examine life, whereas Kill Bill is just, you know, it's a wild, fantastical, visual orgy on some level. But it's also Quentin's sort of humor and his impression of things is very, very different. And it's not meant to be realistic except when he uses realism as an effect, whereas I think this film was trying to reflect and study something, you know, with a responsibility to loyalty to realism, I think.
You play the mother of a daughter in the movie. Is this your first role as a mother? I know you have two children yourself.
I do. I'm trying to think. Where have I had kids before? you know, it's a scary thing when you start working as a teenager and then you literally can't even count how many movies you've made. But I liked playing a mother in this movie. I really crave getting to play more real characters, and I haven't often been cast through my career as a very naturalistic actress. I guess because I was kind of good at doing sort of very stylistic things, and you know how you easily get kind of pigeonholed or pushed in one direction or another. So for me to get to sort of put my hands around an earthy human story is incredibly gratifying.
You've done three movies with Quentin Tarantino, Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill 1 and Kill Bill 2. I'd love to hear how you ended up auditioning for Pulp Fiction, how you found out about it or how he found out about you.
I was actually, what was I, 23, and I was staying in a hotel in California, and I'd been kind of a shut-in because I had an eye infection I got in the pool, and it went from one eye and then to the other, so I hadn't really left the hotel in like 10 days. I kept putting this meeting off with Quentin, who I didn't really know who he was, and I hadn't really seen Reservoir Dogs properly. And we ended up finally meeting once I didn't look like a rabbit, and going out to dinner at the famous Ivy restaurant, I think it was. And we just sat down and talked for about, I don't know, 3-4 hours, I think, until they closed the restaurant. But I hadn't really read the script, but I was pretending that I had. So I kind of had to kind of – I think I'd read some of it, but I was sort of faking that I'd read the script. And I hadn't really seen Reservoir Dogs, although I knew what it was. So I was sort of faking that too. Like, yeah, I liked that. I love that. yeah, the thing, you know, I'd read the breakdown. So it was a very funny meeting. So pretty much I was forced to entertain him and with every other subject to hide, conceal the fact that I hadn't done my homework, which I don't think I succeeded in doing. He busted me on many, many years later. But that was our first meeting.
So you probably had no idea what you were getting yourself into then.
Pretty much no idea, but Quentin's scripts are they're an experience to read, and I find them to the reality or the production of them where his vision ends up looking and what it ends up looking and feeling like to be very, very unique and distinct. So who would have guessed?
Did he have you do an audition or did he just decide he liked you?
Well, it was funny actually. I kept frustrating him because I think I passed on the movie in some way, or I wasn't chasing it, and I think he was fighting to cast me, and then I was sort of resistant. The gimp and the whole rape scene of the boys kind of freaked me out. I was concerned about that, where that was coming from, and so on. And so anyway, he came over to my house, and I think we read the script together. And he was really nice to me. I was a little bit fragile as an actress, I think, at that time. I'd had some difficult experiences in work or something, and it's a long time ago, but I remember that he really did a lot to make me comfortable and enjoy doing the work. I really got back to the joy of acting at that time.
I'm wondering if Quentin Tarantino saw something in yourself that you hadn't seen in yourself. I mean, even just the way he dressed you for it, you know, with the black wig and the bangs. And you have this kind of seductive and cynical way of speaking in it. Had you seen yourself that way before in movies?
No, I hadn't. You know, a lot of the films I did before that were many were period films. And so I always felt I had been trapped in a corset for a long time. And I was trying to break those cords and get into the current day, the present day. And he let me in, you know, into something uber modern. But, you know, the design of the character, the look of the character, we did very much collaboratively, costume and everything.
If you don't mind, let me just play a clip with you and John Travolta from Pulp Fiction. And this is at Jackrabbit Slim's, the 50s-themed restaurant that you're in. And your husband, a dangerous man, has asked Travolta, a hitman, to take you out to dinner. And Travolta likes you, but he's afraid to get too close. He's telling you that he heard that your husband, Marsalis, threw Tony out of a window because of something that had happened with you. And here's where we pick it up.
Don't be shy, Vincent. What else did they say?
Well, I'm not shy.
Did it involve the F word?
No. They just said that Antoine had given you a foot massage.
And
nothing. That's it.
You heard Marsalis threw Tony Rockihar out a four-story window for giving me a foot massage?
Mm-hmm.
Can you believe that?
Well, I mean, at the time I was told, it sounded reasonable.
Marsalis throwing Tony out of a four-story window for massaging my feet seem reasonable?
No, it seemed excessive, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. I mean, I understand that Marsalis is very, very protective of you.
A husband being protective of his wife is one thing. Husband almost killing another man for touching his wife's feet is something else.
But did it happen?
Only thing Antoine ever touched in mine was my hand when he shook it. At my wedding.
Really?
Truth is, nobody knows why Marsalis threw Tony out of that four-story window except Marsalis and Tony. When you little scamps get together, you're worse than a sewing circle.
That's my guest Uma Thurman and John Travolta in a scene from Pulp Fiction. Pulp Fiction remade John Travolta's career, and you were a child when Saturday Night Fever came out.
I think I was like eight or nine.
So what were your images of Travolta? Did you have a strong impression of him?
Well, I had a very strong Vinnie Barbarino impression.
From TV?
Yes. Welcome Back, Kotter. I used to watch that as a child. So that was a big impression to me. And a huge impact was Grease. I think I had the record, or maybe my friend had the record. I remember it was like the one time that we were girls and whatever, little girls in upstate New York. But we had that record and we learned those songs. And Sandra Dee was a lot of fun for us. So, he was a big star of my childhood, I would say, Travolta.
One of the real classic scenes from Pulp Fiction is the dance scene at Jackrabbit Slim's, the 50s restaurant, where there's an MC dressed as Ed Sullivan and the waiters are dressed as 50s people like Buddy Holly or Marilyn Monroe. And you insist that you and Travolta enter the Twist concert, and he's reluctant, but you kind of grab him and you go up there and start dancing. And had you ever danced before? I mean, did you think of yourself as somebody who dances much in public?
Well, not at all, and I'm still not, and I never will be, someone who dances in public. In fact, if you see me dancing in public, call 411, call my mother, because it's a bad sign. But no, so that was actually something so fantastic, because I was, I'm a tall person. I think sometimes tall people can be late bloomers, I think, because we have to kind of grow into our bodies and learn how to find some kind of center of balance. So I always identified with feeling very awkward, and I was really nervous about the dancing. And John and Quentin kind of choreographed it, picked the period dances and put them in a sequence. But by the time I got up there and started doing it, I didn't want to stop, because I'm secretly a big Doris Day fan and Ginger Rogers fan, and I always wanted to be a song and dance girl on some level, which I didn't get to realize till the producers. But that was sort of the beginning of feeling less awkward for me.
Well, in this dance scene, there's a little bit of the twist, the monkey, the swim. Did Quentin have you watch like 60s dance shows or 50s ones like American Bandstand or 60s one like Hullabaloo and Shindig?
No. There were two things. I think one was a scene in The Aristocats, the animated movie. And the other was, I think it was a Roger Vadim film. I can't remember which movie it was, where they do a dance in a record store. Really cool scene, because I think he wanted me to sort of see that this was very cool dancing, very calm, very cool, and very, very settled, groovy. And then the actual doing of it was, we were in these tiny little dinky trailers outside the soundstage in California, and we looked at these two bits of footage from other movies, and John and Quentin were like, hey, what about the Batman? What about this? What about that one? And they kind of made a sequence, and John's a pretty good teacher, I have to say. So you kind of have all you need if he's there. in that regard, you're safe.
What was it like for you when Pulp Fiction came out? It was such an important film. I mean, it's like a landmark in independent cinema. Everything about the film became immediately iconic. So I'm wondering if you were surprised and what impact it had on your life.
I always thought it was going to be good. I was really excited about doing it. I had the time of my life acting in it. But I think I was still pretty insecure, to be honest with you, much more so, And I think that the success of it made me quite nervous. And of course, I didn't feel like any of it was a credit to me. And I was still in the tail end of my, even though I was 24, 25, I think I still had a little bit of the insecure teenager in my personality taking hold. But, because I really missed out on feeling great about it. And I only realized this later when we were preparing for Kill Bill, and Quentin and I watched it again, and I saw what a great film it was. And I really was so proud, and I saw that I was good in it. It wasn't just, the room around me. I also was a contributor. And I realized it was too bad that I had been too, in a way, too kind of shy and frightened to really enjoy the big boom of it when it happened.
Yeah, your character is so not shy in it.
Mm-hmm. I rarely play shy characters. I have my own fears or neuroses have been exposed in a few projects, but not many.
From what I've read, there's a scene from Pulp Fiction that's directly connected to how Kill Bill evolved. And so I want to play that scene and then hear the story behind it. And this is a scene from Pulp Fiction back in the 50s restaurant, Jackrabbit Slim's. You're sitting there with Travolta, and you're talking about a TV pilot that he heard that you did.
I heard you did a pilot.
That was my 15 minutes.
What was it?
It was a show about a team of female secret agents called Fox Force 5.
What?
Fox Force 5. Fox as in we're a bunch of foxy chicks. Force as in we're a force to be reckoned with. And five as in there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 of us. There was a blonde one, Somerset O'Neill. She was a leader. The Japanese fox was a kung fu master. The black girl was a demolition expert. French fox's specialty was sex.
What was your specialty?
Knives. Character I played, Raven McCoy. Her background was she grew up raised by circus performers. According to the show, she was the deadliest woman in the world with a knife. And she knew a zillion old jokes. Her grandfather, an old vaudevillian, taught her. And if we would have got picked up, they would have worked in a gimmick where every show, I would have told another joke.
You know any of them old jokes?
Well, I only got the chance to say one because we only did one show.
Tell me.
It's corny.
Don't be that way. Tell me.
Nah, you wouldn't like it and I'd be embarrassed.
You told like 50 million people and you can't tell me? I promise I won't laugh.
That's what I'm afraid of, Vince.
That's not what I meant. You know it.
Well, now I'm definitely not going to tell you because it's been built up too much.
What a jip.
That's my guest Uma Thurman with John Travolta in a scene from Pulp Fiction. So, Uma Thurman, how does Fox Force 5 figure into the creation of your movie Kill Bill?
Well, the Fox Force 5 are the seeds of the Vipers, the deadly assassination Vipers. So they're Quentin, you know, he has these worlds in which they all live, you know, and these characters sort of they're alive in his mind, and they have all kinds of amazing backstories, and you know, they exist. The Pulp Fiction world and the Kill Bill world are slightly different worlds, but some of the characters, as you can see, cross over and transfer.
So in Kill Bill, you were part of an assassination squad of women.
Mm-hmm.
And Bill, your former lover, finds you about to get married to somebody else and shoots you. 4 years later, you awake from a coma and go on this revenge spree, just crossing off people on your list of people to kill. So when Quentin Tarantino was talking to you about making this film, and you knew that it would require an enormous amount of martial arts choreography.
Well, the film really grew. Like in the very, very beginning of it, Quinn and I were out with all the crew would go out every Friday night after work, you know, the crew and the cast. And so I think it was one Friday night and we were all out someplace in Santa Monica, some sort of sawdust bar. And we got talking and he was always trying to educate me about cinema, which it was clear to him. I think I knew so little. And about genres and this and that. And so we got going about revenge movies, and that's where the concept of Beatrix Kiddo came up. And in the original idea was just the idea of, you know, an opening of a church wedding massacre and the survival of this bride and her just driving into L.A., you know, in a bloodied wedding dress, sworn to revenge. And that was kind of the original idea that came up in that bar. And then there was a phase where Quentin had her on her assassination mission. Bill came up that night. Bill was created right then and there. And then it evolved over years. The whole Hong Kong aspect happened later with him. And it was quite exciting because when he started writing it, we spent a lot of time together. And you know, or he'd call me up from L.A. and read some outrageous scene that he'd come up with. And, you know, you're sort of watching this thing unfold. And basically the creative process really never ended all the way to the point of splitting the story in half and having the two films stand alone, which maybe was always somewhere in his mind based on the material that was shot. But still, he was just constantly throwing out ideas and building worlds and destroying them and building them again.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Uma Thurman, the star of such films as Pulp Fiction, Kill Bill, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, Henry and June, and Dangerous Liaisons. Her new film is called The Life Before Her Eyes. When we left off, we were talking about how she and Quentin Tarantino came up with the idea for Kill Bill, in which she plays an assassin and martial arts expert out for revenge against her former lover, Bill, who shot her and left her in a coma for 4 years. Kill Bill is all about revenge, and I want to play the opening monologue from Kill Bill 2. And we've just seen a flashback in which Bill shoots you at your wedding, and now it's the present day. You're driving in your car, and here's the voiceover.
Looked dead, didn't I? Well, I wasn't. But it wasn't from lack of trying, I can tell you that. Actually, Bill's last bullet put me in a coma. A coma I was to lie in for 4 years. When I woke up, I went on what the movie advertisements refer to as a roaring rampage of revenge. I roared, and I rampaged, and I got bloody satisfaction. I've killed a hell of a lot of people to get to this point. But I have only one more. The last one. The one I'm driving to right now. And when I arrive at my destination, I am gonna kill Bill.
That's Uma Thurman in the opening from Kill Bill 2. Before you started making the movie, could you imagine yourself starring as this, you know, assassin in a martial arts form, being able to kill with knives and swords and martial arts moves?
No. When I went out there in my yellow jumpsuit and, you know, raised my sword, I still had doubts. By the end, I have to tell you, I felt like a pro. By the end, it was actually quite phenomenal what Master Yue Ping did to my brain and my body. It was tough, but it was kind of like I sort of felt like the bionic woman, like I had been killed and rebuilt myself. So it was an amazing rewiring that took place there.
So this is the martial arts expert who trained you, who you just referred to?
Yes, he's a director and a choreographer himself. And one of his choreographies he's most famous for is Crouching Tiger.
Oh, yeah.
And he's just a brilliant, brilliantly talented man, and, you know, special, very special. We call him the master, and so I called him the master. He was my master, and his fight team, who made Kill Bill, and who are the Crazy 88, many of them, and they're really amazing guys, and they're all based in Hong Kong primarily, and I really miss them. I mean, they really changed my life in a very touching, strong way. They're really special people.
Although you killed most of them.
I had to kill them. I had to hit them with things. I took a few licks and hits myself, I'll tell you that.
You said that the master rewired your brain, not just your body. How did he change your brain?
He turned me into a coordinated person for the first time in my life. I participated, but, you know, it's difficult to learn. We forget when we kind of get into our adult lives and we... we avoid as much stress as we can, but we learn how to kind of avoid places where we struggle. And when you have to go back and learn something from the very beginning, it's humbling because you have to go into that place where you struggle, where you can't do, where you're hurting and you're humiliated and you want to stop and you don't, and you have to continue and you have to find strength to continue. And then you break through and you learn a little bit more and you learn a little bit more. And then, you know, in this case of Kill Bill, every time I could do one thing, they gave me another thing to do. So it was just a constant process of struggle and learning. And, you know, really it just changes your brain. I think they made my brain younger for a while because my brain just had to become razor sharp again. And it could go back to a much more flexible state than pregnancy, gardening, and mothering had sort of put me.
What was his approach to teaching you? Was he encouraging or was he more the authoritarian?
They were very encouraging to me because they could see I worked hard. You know, it's like you're trying to do something and you can't do it and you're swinging a stick around and it hits you in the face, hits you in the head, you swing it around, you do it again. You have tears running down your face practically and you keep trying. So they were very nice to me because they could see that I really didn't give up and I wasn't a baby. Too much. I was a bit of a baby, but so they were nice to me.
Would you just list some of the things your character is subjected to and some of the blows she takes and gives in Kill Bill 1 and 2, particularly 1?
Well, I mean, there's a battle, like, you know, where I kill the 88, and then that went on literally what seemed like forever. And I do everything from jump off of balconies, land on tables, which I'm afraid of heights. You know, I'd had wires on, but, you know, so finally I do it. So I jump off the balcony, land on the table. Finally, I get that right. And then, you know, the camera's on, got to do it again. Finally, then I do it again. And I get it right again. And they go, oh, good, she can do that. Let's have three guys charge at her and she can she can now add 7 sword moves to that, which, by the way, is pretty scary because, you know, if you add, you know, sword moves in on short notice, the brain has to really process them because if the sword is in the wrong place at the wrong time, you either hit someone or you get hit or, you know, all sorts of trouble breaks loose.
Is this short? Was the sword sharp?
They were sharp, but they were wood, the ones that you're swinging really fast. But, you know, if any slender thing, you know, hits your face and you don't know if, you know, you're going to open the skin.
Yeah. Yeah, you bet. Well, Kill Bill, I believe, was delayed because you were pregnant, and you shot it after you gave birth. So how soon after becoming a mother did you actually shoot the first part of Kill Bill?
I think about 6 months. I think Levon was almost 6 months.
That's kind of amazing because it's so difficult, I think, for your body to get back into shape and to feel like yourself again after you give birth. And here you are doing all this martial arts stuff that you'd never done before.
Well, first of all, you never feel like yourself again after you have a kid because mm-hmm. you aren't the same self. So that weird feeling of where is myself is a permanent state of being, isn't it? I think many mothers probably feel that. But it's actually kind of like, you know, the new beginning of some other self. But yeah, it was really difficult, I have to say. It really wasn't an easy thing to do.
What were some of the movies Tarantino asked you to watch while making Kill Bill?
We looked at The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Clint Eastwood was a big hero for me in this as the Kill Bill character because, you know, he could have written me a piece where I got to really do what I love to do, which is talk and emote and dissect things. But instead, he gave me this sort of very silent, powerful, emotional, physical, like, you know, totally opposite to what would be more comfortable for me to do, you know. And so I really needed to figure out how to hold that person, that character, and all these crazy things that were around, you know, hold the movie together kind of without a lot to say, without a lot of chance to let people in. So I kind of was really into the Clint Eastwood trilogy characters because he barely said a word and but yet there was just such a world in his eyes. And
his eyes, exactly, yeah. Well, he's got that squint too.
He has that squint, which I tried to impersonate here and there. But the dignity and the sort of awesome power of the silence.
You know, the opening scene of Kill Bill, when you're lying there and you've been shot and you're bloodied, there's blood all over your teeth and your face, and it's shot in black and white, and so you really look like death. Was it at all disconcerting to see that when you actually watched what you looked like?
Well, I'm usually the one in the makeup trailer going, let's put some more over there. And let's put some here. There's actually a really funny, there's an amazing little Polaroid that my makeup artist took of me in the yellow jumpsuit. And I'm covered with blood and with my blonde Charlie's Angels kind of hair. And my daughter is there in a little mini yellow jumpsuit that the beautiful Chinese wardrobe department and our wardrobe supervisor, Helen, had made for her. And then there's my baby son, who's 6 months old, in his mini yellow jumpsuit. And I've got my jumper pulled up, and I'm nursing him. And I'm just sitting there with my two kids, you know, covered in blood, and all of us in jumpsuits. And it's just – it's really classic. So, you know, call me crazy.
My guest is Uma Thurman, the star of such films as Kill Bill, Pulp Fiction, The Truth About Cats and Dogs, and the new film, The Life Before Her Eyes. Here's a scene from her 1988 film, Dangerous Liaisons, set in 18th century France. Thurman plays Cecile, a virtuous young girl who is being forced by her mother into an arranged marriage with an older man. But Cecile is in love with her music instructor. John Malkovich plays the Vicomte Valmont, who pretends he wants to help her but intends to seduce her. In this scene, he's just snuck into her bedroom where she's asleep. His touch awakens her.
What do you want?
Well, I don't know. What do you think?
No!
All right. I just want you to give me a kiss.
A kiss?
That's all.
And then will you go?
Then I'll go.
Promise.
Whatever you say.
All right. I mean, will you go now?
Oh, I don't think so.
But you promised.
I promised to go when you gave me a kiss. You didn't give me a kiss. I gave you a kiss. Not the same thing at all.
And if I give you a kiss?
Let's just get ourselves more comfortable, shall we?
When you started your acting career, what kind of roles did you expect to be cast in?
I wanted to get to do wonderful things, you know, like Annie Hall, like Silkwood, like Pillow Talk, you know? I mean, those were, I wanted to get to do those kind of women and, you know, communicate the experience of being a woman both with humor and with drama. You know, that's all I wanted to do.
Well, you mentioned Pillow Talk. I mean, a few of your early movies are far more sexual in the bedroom than Pillow Talk ever was. And thinking like in Dangerous Liaisons when, you know, John Malkovich comes into your bedroom and seduces you. And in one of those scenes, you're topless. And then you played June in Henry and June about Henry Miller, which was a pretty sexual film, too. Were you prepared for that?
No, I wasn't. And I think that actually can be, I don't know, I think because I was tall, well, in general anyway in my life, because I was sort of independent and very precocious, you know, verbally and otherwise, people often took me for being older than I was or more knowledgeable or more womanly than I actually was. And I think that's something that was always kind of challenging, you know. I was playing parts that the female experience had not happened to me. Do you know? And there you are. You know, but like imagine that for any young girl. Like all you want to do is be taken as a woman, right? I mean, that's, you know, you don't want to be taken as a kid. But you really don't know what you're doing or what it's about. You're imitating maturity. You don't really understand it. So that can be hard because you don't really control it. Like having people find you very sexy or something like that. It's one thing, I think, if you're kind of in your own skin about that. But if you're not, it's kind of weird that people project onto you stuff that you're not really, you can't handle or you don't really know what it is.
Were your directors sensitive to that?
Sometimes. Some were. Some were. Some weren't. You know, being a director requires, I think, a little bit of ruthlessness or brings it out because directors are trying to corral and, you know, coerce so many people on in this death-defying act on a day-to-day basis of either getting a scene or not getting the scene. And so many people can screw it up and so much pressure is on them that I think it's difficult for directors to worry about sensitivity training because it's very stressful.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Uma Thurman, and her new movie is called The Life Before Her Eyes. You were brought up as a Buddhist, or at least by a father who is Buddhist. Your father, Robert Thurman, is a scholar of Tibetan Buddhism and was the first American to be ordained as a Buddhist monk. So were there certain Buddhist principles you grew up with?
Yes. Oh, yeah, all over the place. And the you know, the whole conversation was about that. The Buddhism as a philosophy is a really good one. This is the simple guidelines and responsibilities of cause and effect and karma, and I think they're really excellent. And so I was brought up with that.
So what was emphasized to you as a child before you were able to really understand like the larger philosophy of the religion?
Yes, that's what I understood more as a child. I mean, I was always, but you know, I think I always wanted to be normal, like all kids. You know, everything that came across as strange or set you apart from your peers was kind of stressful for me. So I think that the Buddhism fell into that category. You know, I think I wanted to go to church and sing the song with everybody else and just feel part of things. But the prescription was to be different than that. So so I think maybe I could have probably gotten more out of it if I hadn't wanted so desperately to be normal.
Well, you spent part of your childhood in India. What did you find most interesting about India?
Most interesting about India? There's no end to the interest of India. But what did I find? Well, when I was there as a baby, which of course I don't remember. And I remember when I was 9, I guess, going back. And I really think that it was an amazing experience as a child to leave America and spend a long, protracted time in that culture. It certainly made you see the condition of life on a very different level and the struggle of life not to take for granted, and then also to see the amazing amount of joy within hardship, which is something you don't always see in sort of a white middle-class background, that kind of celebration amongst having so many gifts that we have, you know. So I don't know, it was very powerful experience for me.
Part of what makes you so stunning as an actress is your height. You're about 6 feet tall. Your full lips. I'm wondering if those things were things that kids picked on when you were young, because as you've pointed out, being different is never good.
Those two. Yeah. Those two. The height was bad, and the big mouth and the big nose and the wide set eyes was all a problem. It's all a very big problem.
But you started modeling when you were 15, so you had to know by then that there was something, you know, uniquely beautiful about you. So how did you start modeling if you were self-conscious because kids were mocking you for the things that became your assets?
Well, what is an asset as a sort of exotic-looking model, which isn't necessarily the definition of pretty in Amherst, Massachusetts, in 1983, I was not the definition of that there. But my mother, you know, my mother is Swedish and German, and my mother was this sort of famous beauty, and much more than me. You look at her pictures, and she was like a really exquisite, perfect-looking woman. And I was never a good model. I didn't really have that much success at that. But at least I always knew that I didn't really want to be a model, or that I also knew that I wasn't going to be a very successful one. On top of it, but see, the modeling really was a means to have my independence and fund it and get to my acting classes. My first film I really only did it for 2 summers too, because I went one summer took acting classes and did some modeling, and then I went back to school. And then I went the next summer, and by the end of that summer, I was in my first film. So when I was 16, I made my first movie.
That's so young.
Mm-hmm. And I thought I wasn't a child actor. That's a funny one. I remember that.
Uma Thurman, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very, very much. Have a great day.
Uma Thurman stars in the new film, The Life Before Her Eyes. It opens in several cities this Friday. The music known as Boogie Woogie was an early variety of jazz, a rolling and complex style of blues piano with some syncopated Cuban rhythms thrown in. It arose around the turn of the last century, but became a national craze in the late 1930s and early 40s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new anthology of Boogie Woogie and Blues Piano.
A lot of New Orleans pianists learned that fancy bit. That's Yancey Stomp, 1939, by Chicago's Jimmy Yancey, whose left-hand lope could sound a little rough. Boogie piano was an early branch of jazz, an early refinement of the blues, a sort of dialogue between the pianist's hands. The left usually plays a steady bass pattern, while the right piles lines and contrasting rhythms on top. The practice may have evolved out of the dialogue between a blues singer's voice and guitar. This is Yancey again, on piano and singing.
See one letter, little girls all dressed in red. I received one letter, little girls all dressed in red. Then he said down the bottom, Jim, your baby's dead.
Some of the earliest self-taught boogie pianists played for tips and logging camps in the Deep South. They traveled from one camp to another by rail, often as hobos. The mode of transport left its mark on the music. As boogie developed, the endlessly varied click-clack of railroad cars rolling over switches and bridges put polyrhythms in a pianist's ears. The music also grew in speed and momentum until you could hear its distant roots in West African percussion choirs with their busy and layered rhythms. Here's Honky Tonk Train Blues by Chicago's Mead Lux Lewis, a bit younger than Yancey. He didn't ride the rods, but grew up near the tracks. This music's from a 3-CD mini box from Mosaic Records, available from their website. I've been listening to it a lot. Boogie Woogie and Blues Piano collects solos, duos, and even piano trios, pianists accompanying singers, and boogie and blues combos led by Lionel Hampton, Benny Carter, Harry James, and Red Allen. It skims records made for Columbia and Victor between 1935 and 41, the years when boogie mushroomed into a national craze. Its originators were specialists, but the music soon infected players groomed in other styles. Kansas City bluesman Pete Johnson, schooled in ragtime, often worked with one of the stars of this set, singing bartender, blues shouter, and proto-rock and roller Joe Turner.
Roll it, boy, let 'em jump for joy.
By the early 1940s, this African-American working-class music became a commercial property, and white bands hopped on the piano wagon. Will Bradley had his Beat Me Daddy 8 to the Bar and the Andrews Sisters their Boogie Woogie Bugle Boy. After World War II, boogie would invade country music. Will Bradley's 1940 Down the Road a Piece anticipates that trend, and drummer Ray McKinley's half-drawled, half-spoken delivery predicts Bob Dylan's Basement Tapes. Freddie Slack is on piano.
Hey, if you want to hear some boogie, then I know the place. It's just an old piano in a knocked-out bass. The drummer man's a guy they call 8-Beat Mac. You remember Doc and old Beat Me Daddy Slack. Boy, it's better than chicken fried in bacon grease. Come along with me, it's just down the road a piece.
The boogie trend had run its course in American jazz by the end of World War II. But its influence kept spreading, and not only to country music and rock and roll. Boogie Woogie was the sound American troops had brought to the world and became a post-war craze in occupied Japan and in Europe. Dutch composer Louis Andriessen has written boogie passages into a couple of works, including an homage to Jimmy Yancey. But then you can hear echoes of this patterned, textured take on the blues everywhere, from Jerry Lee Lewis to Philip Glass.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed the new Boogie Woogie and Blues piano box set on the Mosaic label.